Because, sometimes you can get to that second contract, which is the ultimate goal, and you say, okay, you could splurge now, but then you get hurt after that initial year. Like, what do you do now? And so, you may have sort of guaranteed money coming in, but most athletes, whenever they get hurt or whenever their career stops, that's not when the spending stops, because a lot of times we think we'll heal up, or even if we got cut, we'll just get back in the NFL. So it does become difficult and sometimes a tough pill to swallow. And we got to say, hey, our career is probably over, or we're not going to be able to make the same type of money outside of football and build something. And so a lot of times you hit that year three and year four, and your money is just not necessarily up, but you start to see maybe the writing on the wall, like, hey, I might need to start making some changes.
Welcome to Self-Equity, the podcast that dives into the inspiring journeys of founders, entrepreneurs, athletes, and entertainers. I'm your host, Jolene Tepedino, authorized officer and team business manager for the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group at UBS. Welcome back to episode 32 of Self-Equity. Today, we're joined by Kellen Mond, a former SEC quarterback and one of the most accomplished signal callers in Texas A&M history. He was selected in the third round of the 2021 NFL Draft by the Minnesota Vikings and went on to spend time with the Vikings, Browns, and Colts, experiencing the NFL from the inside, multiple locker rooms and systems. In this episode, we talk about Kellen's journey from being a longtime college starter to navigating life as a professional quarterback, the realities of the NFL, leadership, resilience, and what he's taken from every stage of his career. Joining me as co-host today is Ryan Lynch, financial advisor with the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group. Kellen, welcome to our Self-Equity podcast. Great to have you on today.
I'm blessed to be on. I appreciate y'all for having me.
Kellen, for anyone that might not know you, can you give us a little introduction and tell us about yourself?
Yeah, of course. My name is Kellen Mond. I think most people know me in the football world, whether me playing football at Texas A&M or some of the NFL teams that I played for. But now I'm an artist and photographer. And usually you don't see athletes move into the creative space, but it's honestly been a fun journey for me, being able to explore this space and also create something from scratch out of it.
That's great, Kellen. Thanks for sharing that. And was there a turning point that you can remember where you truly believed I can play in the NFL?
Probably early on in college, but I think even like whenever you first start off in high school, the whole idea of getting offers and going to college was extremely foreign, especially once I got my first offer. I didn't even know that was the way to get to college. And so I think once you get to college, a lot of people sort of have that three and done mindset. Obviously, it's a little bit different now with NIL and more players wanting to stay in college. But, you know, at least when I was playing, most guys are like, how can I do my 3 years and then I'm going to be good enough to go to the NFL? And so I think that was sort of my mindset. And obviously I ended up playing 4 years. But I think early on, you sort of have that mindset of, if I can make it to college, I can make it to the NFL. And what's going to stop me?
You know, you talk about NIL. Obviously, that's changed collegiate sports dramatically. So going back to your recruiting period, kind of looking into college, what were some of the factors, because NIL wasn't a thing for you, that really drew you to Texas A&M? How'd you pick that? Where was your mindset of how am I going to get to those next steps?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times when you look at certain schools from a development standpoint, it's really hard to sort of evaluate, especially once you're in high school and you're sort of picking through different college routes, especially with Texas A&M. At the time, it was the only SEC school in Texas before UT joined. Obviously, they have a huge alumni base, huge fan base, and being able to play in Kyle Field. And then you sort of saw certain weapons and certain caliber of players that they're able to get. You know, Christian Kirk was there whenever I first got there, but was part of a bit of a recruiting pick, so I'll be able to throw to Christian Kirk and things of that nature. So, you know, I think it was a lot of different things that were playing, you know, different factors at different time periods. And then once you go visit, you go to a game and your mindset is like, man, I can play in this. And so, you know, I think once you go see a game, most athletes, especially me being a quarterback, I was pretty sold.
You look at some of the opportunities, especially in the SEC. These colleges are in a lot of times smaller towns and areas where there's not an NFL team. So you guys are the show, right? You're the biggest in the area. Now, I know you followed another guy who probably would have crushed it in the NIL time if he had the chance, in Johnny Manziel. Like, what kind of opportunities do you think would be out there for you in the SEC? And like you said, what is some advice you get to current student athletes and prospective student athletes looking to go and play, and how best to take advantage of those opportunities while not getting taken advantage of?
Yeah, I mean, Johnny in this landscape would have crushed. I mean, probably more, you know, just on the same ballpark with Cam Newton and Tim Tebow, but on a bigger scale because of what Texas A&M brings. You know, unless you're at Ohio State, maybe Notre Dame, some of these big-time public schools who have, one, infrastructure and a quality football program, but also have the capital to be able to distribute out to some of these big-time players, then you're probably not going to be on a level of Johnny Manziel. So, you know, I think a large part of it is it's sort of difficult because the whole goal was for athletes to be able to get paid. Now, I think it was a little bit different. Certain things that we were arguing for was if a A&M alumni wanted to take me to lunch, he should have the ability to take me to lunch and pay for it. Like, that shouldn't mean I'm breaking any sort of legal rules and stuff like that. Or if I wanted to go online or on Instagram and say, hey, I'm selling my pair of cleats, I don't think anyone predicted it would turn into, hey, we want to give you $5 million or $1 million so we can get you to come to our university and play. And I don't know if it'll sort of swing back into maybe a more restricted version. I don't know if we went a little bit too far, but you know, I think athletes still have to understand that football is still the main thing. Academics is also part of the main thing, so you can be on the field. Obviously, the goal is, you know, to make money. And I don't even blame guys who try and stay in college longer, unless you're sort of a bona fide first round pick. And so that's sort of my thing. If you're not a bona fide first round pick, I don't blame you if you stay in college as long as you can to be able to make as much money as you can. Because once you hit the NFL, that's usually sort of that when your timeline is starting to wind down and, you know, you're starting to get into maybe what the real world may actually look like in the future.
Yeah, I was just at an event at Villanova where I went to school, and we do a lot in the NIL space with collegiate athletes. So just being on campus to help them with that. And Jay Wright, who was our coach for a long time, was telling a story about how early on in his tenure in the early 2000s, his team got in trouble because they took phone cards as an impermissible benefit. I didn't even know what phone cards were. I guess it was a way for like you to make long distance phone calls, like prepaid on a thing. So the guy got suspended for like half the season for that. He's like, and now they're getting paid $1 million to play basketball. He's like, it was like $50 in phone cards. And that dude brought up Iowa State, the whole tattoo scandal.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. And not much long before you got there. So the world's really changed a lot.
I mean, the amount of things that guys probably got caught for. I mean, I remember still being in college and whenever you are sort of floating on the borderline between do we think it's legal versus not. These are certain things that you sort of play off in your head, like, hey, should I do this? You know, probably 90% of the chance you're not going to get caught. So you sort of have that plan in your head. But it is sort of that other 10% where you're like, man, I definitely don't want to risk missing a quarter of the season or missing a season because I violated rules and I went to go network and do lunch with some of our alumni. And so it was quite difficult back then.
To that end, in a way, when we talk about financial literacy, you know, you'd have to be financially literate to know what you can accept and what you can't accept. But looking back, were there any programs that you remember or any kind of preparation that you were given to sort of understand financial literacy as it pertains to football as a career?
I think a lot of times we as athletes, I would say majority of athletes, we don't utilize or take the programs that were put in front of us serious enough. Part of that is sort of what I said at the beginning. We think that football is our all and be all. And if we made it to college, then we're going to make it to the NFL. And if I'm going to make it to the NFL, why do I need to learn how to handle my money when I'm just going to have a wealth advisor do everything for me and sort of have everyone do certain things for me so I can strategically and specifically just work on football. And so, you know, I think a lot of times the read and tape networking series in college, and, you know, we were presented with whether donors, alumni who came to speak to us, there was never anything in our mind of let's go introduce ourselves, let's build a relationship, let's scheduling a conversation to go visit their facility or their office space. You know, those certain things were quite rare for us as athletes. And so a lot of times you're sort of looking back and you never realize which resources you actually need. And, you know, in terms of networking, until you're actually out of ball and you realize how actually important that is. So it is sort of a difficult pill to swallow when we sort of look at, you know, sometimes the majors that we picked and minors are not useful. And, you know, other things that we did here in college sometimes can be like, man, I didn't learn anything, or it was a bit of a waste because we didn't utilize the resources that we, you know, had right in front of us. And I think a lot of it is sort of that football, sometimes that athlete mindset, not having a plan B, and sort of that plan B is business and networking. But I think there is a fine line of you being able to do both. And, you know, especially if you're networking with your alumni, there's a very, very high chance that they're going to want to connect and meet and build relationships with athletes, especially football players.
You have to put your trust in these other advisors, right? And you have to have a good sense of an intuition. You know, are they good guys? Are they bad guys? Are they doing it by the rules? Are they stealing from me? Are they, you know, doing things that are in my best interest? Or, you know, while I have my head down, I'm playing, what's going on around me, right? And I think that landscape has changed over the years, which is a good thing. We touched a little bit on NIL in the beginning. So you finished college right before NIL changed everything. What was your initial reaction, you know, when you heard of it and NIL was out there?
So like you said, 2020 was my last year. I guess it became legal, or you want to describe it, in 2021. But 2021 was sort of the buffer year, sort of a feel out year, because no one wanted to admit that they could actually pay players. And essentially you were sort of buying players. Once 2022 rolled around, it was sort of a free for all. And then you start getting the transfer portal. A lot of those restrictions were taken down. So it is a bit of a chaotic mess when you think of the NIL and transfer portal when those two come together. You know, I can't blame any sort of school. You know, I definitely wish there was a bit more structure in terms of how guys were getting paid. And, you know, it's not just, hey, I'm going to give you $1 million and you're going to come here, and there's no deliverables. You know, NFL at the highest level, they certainly have incentives and deliverables on, hey, yes, you had your base, but if you go and accomplish these things, usually these things will help the team, and then you get paid X amount of dollars. College football landscape would definitely benefit from having a lot more restrictions on the transfer portal and it not be so just free-flowing. I think if guys can just leave whenever they want, go to new programs, go to new schools, you're bringing in new guys, it becomes quite impossible to build true programs. And, you know, even 5 years ago, obviously 10 years ago, you saw teams that were able to build programs, and, you know, a lot of the national championship teams were guys who had been in that program for 3 and sometimes even 4 years. You know, now Fernando Mendoza, how long was he at Indiana? Obviously, they did a great job providing a lot of structure, obviously really good coaches. You know, some of these teams that are really good and bad, they just are, everyone's sort of on 1 year deals. And I think you have a greater chance at building programs and I think developing players, which we will start to see if the NFL starts to get affected by the lack of development with players, and that they have a certain say so when it comes to the college football under certain dynamic.
From a fan perspective, the hardest part is to know who's where. Because it feels like every season you turn on the TV, and it's like that guy was the quarterback, like you said, at Cal, now he's at Indiana. And the Indiana guy's now at Duke. And like, where, you don't know anybody anymore, which is a very small part of it. Like, Texas A&M is a great example of something I think is a major issue in college football specifically, where a couple of years ago under Jimbo, they recruited, I think, the top rated recruiting class of all time, spent a bunch of money. And then the next year, it was like 80% roster turnover, where it almost looks like guys go as top recruits to get paid, And then they don't want to stay, get developed, or they didn't even want to be there in the first place, but they just want the biggest check, and then they transfer. So you don't get developed properly. You don't get continuity, like you said. And then the school's kind of sitting there like, well, what did we just pay for, right? The lack of deliverable is a major issue.
Yeah. And you know, I think it is quite different because a lot of times people will reference in the real world and in business, you can get up and leave your job and go to a different company. College coaches can move. I think the one thing that people miss is that as much as we want to compare it to professional sports and all these different factors, is it can never be professional sports as long as academics is involved and as long as the university is involved. When you're on a professional level, it's simply people at the highest level who aren't required to do any sort of academic work or anything like that. When you're on a college level, if you do not pass your classes, you cannot be on the field. So you are more dependent on, you know, somewhat being successful or at least passing classes than even certain deliverables when it comes to the football side. And so as much as people, we try to make it a professional sport because the pay structure, and sometimes you're actually paid in many ways more as a college football player than even, you know, an NFL player, which a lot of things are already really structured. So it sort of brings in a lot of conflict, whether are these professional athletes, are they semi-pros? You know, whenever we start developing sort of this, private equity firms are now getting involved with college sports. You know, how will that change the dynamic? Do we have the right to kick players off of teams because it's now professional? Now, what if I went to the school because I knew Texas A&M would give me a great degree and I know that now I'm getting kicked off the team? So I don't know. I think it can become an even bigger mess once you incorporate it into the professional landscape, because it simply can't operate in a professional landscape because of the academics and the university side.
Yeah, you look across the country, the money is just so big. And there's a really good argument for why students that we shouldn't get some part of it, because they're bringing a lot of that value. But yeah, I agree with you. There needs to be some adults in the room to make sure that, like, the main thing is kept. And that, you know, it kind of gets reined back in so that you get duly compensated, but you also make sure that these kids are getting a great education, which is the whole point of college athletics.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And I think part of, you know, it's not maybe something that I fear, but we do live in a society where everyone's like, how can I make the big buck, create something very innovative and get in front of certain things? And so a lot of times people with big money or companies with a lot of money will try and get into the college football landscape or even college sports. It's like, how much money can I make? And even if it's at the detriment to players and the game and the product on the field, it's like, well, I made my change. And so, you know, I think the NFL, you know, and even other sports leagues have done somewhat of a good job with at least people coming in have to have certain requirements. You know, a lot of times, you know, some of these are financial advisors and wealth advisors are certified through the NFL. You know, agents are obviously certified through the NFL, and, you know, a lot of them are lawyers and attorneys. To work with a college athlete, you need no certification. You just need to know a college athlete, and maybe you're the medium to be able to help get that person to a college. And you may not even have connections, and so you don't even have any legal paperwork. You have no business. And so it can get really complicated and dicey on who can you trust and who does good quality business versus who is just someone who's just in there to, you know, make money off of the players and make the percentage.
Yeah, that's a big concern of ours. You know, there's always bad actors in a variety of ways. And you're dealing with people, you mentioned it earlier, you're 17 years old when you get on campus. I mean, these are children and oftentimes come from families with backgrounds that haven't been exposed to mass income, right? Like, see, look at their paychecks coming in at a very young age. All the media scrutiny, all the opportunities, people throwing a lot of things at you. It's overwhelming for almost anybody to try to handle all of that, mm-hmm. especially if you're at a high, you know, profile position like you were. But if you're just not experienced in this realm, it can be overwhelming and easy to make mistakes. And if you have a lot of people trying to come in with their hands out to take advantage of young people, and it happens a lot, it's an issue. Like, our team, we're fortunate that we're certified with the NFLPA, to work with athletes because, you know, it's important that we work with young people. We can show, like, no, we are the real deal. But yeah, fortunately, there's so many people coming into the space right now and kids making money and not trying to make bad decisions, but it's almost hard not to in a way.
Yeah. And I can't imagine where the college football landscape will be in 10, even 5 years. I mean, the amount of money that's being flushed into it, you know, over the last 5 years. And then now I think people are starting to see maybe opportunities, growth. You know, I think, like I said, 2021, when a lot of this stuff was sort of first figuring itself out, the sort of how can we just feel the landscape? You know, we don't want to make mistakes, but now people are sort of just throwing money in at a lot of players. And then, you know, we'll probably start seeing a lot of these college campuses trying to develop infrastructure where it's not only just the stadium. It's like, how can we provide experiences around them? And it's not just the college town and local bars. It's how can we provide experiences around the campus and around, you know, the center of athletics. So, you know, I think over the next 5 years, now that we're about 5 years into NIL, we'll start to see what is truly going to stick for maybe the long run until maybe there's more restrictions and what definitely is sort of a waste of time.
Kellen, how has your approach to the game evolved from college to your rookie year with the Vikings to your time with the Browns and the Saints? What is that shift like?
You know, I think in college, you know, being under Jimbo, and I was with Jimbo for 3 years. He's not, you know, to sort of get accustomed to systems and play calls and, you know, really how to execute at a high level. And then jumping into another system your rookie year, and things are totally different. A full playbook and huddle calls and things like that are totally different than the college landscape. And so being able to adapt, you know, especially early, especially, you know, those first few weeks and months when you first get in was difficult. And then it's sort of just that ongoing process of learning new game plans, learning new installs every week. You know, the piece where I do think sort of being thrown everything at you whenever you're young and whenever you're a rookie is once you get to sort of that second and third year, you know, whenever I got to the Browns and especially when I got to the Colts, once you've already learned sort of two and three NFL systems, your ability to learn another system, no matter how foreign it is, becomes way easier. You sort of already develop a certain process on how to learn systems, you know, the way you take notes, the way you do certain things throughout the day to help you remember long play calls and, you know, how to execute at a high level. So, you know, I think it was always simply just a growth process. You know, I think especially once you get to the NFL, a lot of it is really sort of trial and error. And, you know, you can sort of copy some of what the vets were doing, you know, Kirk Cousins and Sean Mannion, who are one's now offensive coordinator for the Eagles. And then Kirk Cousins, I believe, is still with the Falcons. So that was my rookie quarterback room, who are brilliant, smart guys. So I was able to take certain things. But at the end of the day, it's like, how do you learn best? How can you develop your own style of play while still being able to learn from the veterans and people in that locker room and sort of develop your own system of learning and playing?
It's fascinating. You talk about development. I think a big part of it, especially in the NFL level, is one, you have shortened training camps where you're on two-a-days. Like, there's just fewer reps to go around. You get the season. If you're a backup or third-string quarterback, you might get some, you know, practice squad reps, like showing the defense, but you're not real. There's just not enough time anymore. I think that's been a development since the 2011 CBA. But also, one thing that I've always been fascinated by, especially for quarterbacks, is that first year for you, for example, right? You play your whole season at A&M. You play your bowl game. You go to the Senior Bowl, combine, draft, and then you're just rolling. And so there's almost no offseason. So what is that whirlwind like, especially for somebody who comes in and maybe has to start right away or, you know, is in a competition? How do you go from college campus to all those workouts to try to, one, settle your personal life? Again, you just signed a contract after getting drafted, making new money. There's a whole new financial life and understanding while trying to learn a new playbook, a new city, new teammates. That has to be the biggest whirlwind in professional sports.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think, obviously, you have maybe family trying to get involved, finance, all these different outside factors, but I do think the real overload, whether good or bad, is the football component when, especially as a quarterback, once you get there, you know, things are moving fast. We have usually 7, maybe 9 installs, and you're doing each install a day. Each one has, you know, maybe 100, 150 pages. So you are learning a lot, and it's how can you learn this? You go into practice, you try and execute it. You learn your sort of corrections and certain things that you messed up. And then you go into learn day two, you get prepared day two, and you sort of just rinse and repeat every single day. So a lot of it is like, how can you still retain the information that you learn day one as we move on to day two? And then remember day one and two as we move on to day three. And so, like I said, it is a lot more difficult for young guys who are first coming into the league who never really learned extensive play calls like that, especially because the college landscape is so different versus, you know, you're a 2-3 year vet, or maybe you're a 10 year vet and you've had to learn multiple systems. And so you going into an install is honestly nothing. You know, you sort of have your sort of methods and your ways to be able to learn NFL playbooks. How do you learn the operation? Can you now be comfortable when going into a practice and, you know, your head isn't sort of like a, you know, just sort of squirming everywhere just because you're trying to figure out what is the exact path and what do I need to do today? And am I doing things right? And so probably year two, especially year three, sort of the comfortability level is definitely there. And I think also coaches, depending on which coaches, start to treat you a little bit more like a vet once you start hitting that level, and they're not so hands-on and trying to overcorrect these different things. So, you know, I think that's where you start to see a lot of guys, if they're able to make it that far, start to hit their stride and start to become a little bit more comfortable within systems and within the NFL than even sometimes where their first year, it's just sort of every day they're trying to learn something new while also trying to retain information.
And one of the things that we've seen is in the NFL this year more than ever with Baker Mayfield's resurgence and then Sam Darnold certainly is that, you know, it takes guys a long time sometimes. You have bad coaching, bad weapons around you, or maybe it just took you a little longer to get going. The saying that organizations fail quarterbacks before quarterbacks fail organizations.
Yeah.
From your personal history, you know, and what you know as a football player at the NFL level, what's the truth to that? What's the reason for some of the late blossoming quarterbacks we've seen? Just kind of your thoughts on that.
You know, I think I sort of think of it like sort of three tiers. You have your organization, which obviously is controlling the personnel in the building, whether coaches and players. But also I think a large part of it is sort of the controlling the energy in the building, like providing a quality culture in the building, which I think is really important. Then I think you have the systems, which are the offensive systems, the play design, play calling on both the offensive and these defensive side of the ball, special teams as well. And then you have the actual players, which are the personnel. And so I think it takes a lot of things to go right. And if one of those components is missing, then you will miss out and you won't make the playoffs, or a lot of times you won't be able to reach that super high potential or maybe meet your expectations of what you thought you could while you were in the NFL. And so, you know, I think, you know, we see Sam Darnold, and I knew Sam Darnold was a really good quarterback from a talent level, but I thought he was good once he was with the 49ers. And he didn't have many opportunities to play because Brock Purdy never got hurt, or, you know, he was pretty much playing the whole time. But I think when you look at Sam Darnold, I think he was able to get in maybe some garbage time, or maybe he got in one game and actually played well. Obviously, 49ers have a really good culture. Kyle Shanahan has a brilliant system, and then players around him, and then as an individual, for him to succeed. Same thing in Minnesota. And then obviously Sam Darnold goes to the Seahawks, and they have a really good defense, really good personnel. They have a quarterback who's really good, and then they have a system that can sort of be fit around that specific player. So outside people, fans, and then even people probably within the building don't understand that how many different factors go into the success of a player, especially a quarterback. And, you know, it's like, oh, well, we've seen flashes of him, but we never were able to see him develop. It's like, was he in the right system? Was he a part of a good culture of a team? And was he being developed in the proper way? And so it's definitely not the sort of black and white thing. It's very gray. And so many things have to go right for an athlete and a player at that level to succeed.
So you mentioned Minnesota. Kind of taking it back to you, obviously you got drafted there, third round pick. And, you know, you spent a year there. If you could look back and kind of take where of those three areas you just mentioned, like what were some of the things that affected you to where you moved down to Cleveland? And looking back on it, what's been some introspective things that you're taking into your new career that, you know, like maybe you can improve upon as an artist?
Yeah. I mean, I think one, for instance, and I, you know, it's some way, I guess you could laugh about it now, but I don't think it's very beneficial for a player to have his head coach walk out of the draft room whenever they draft you. Sort of the main person who controls the energy in the building was not a big fan of you. And so that probably doesn't help out. I mean, even my rookie year, I ended up missing 10 days of practice because I got COVID. And, you know, we sort of talked earlier about how important reps are in the NFL. And, you know, especially when you're a rookie, training camp is your, especially as a high draft pick, you're going to be able, you're definitely going to get reps. And that's where you sort of load in all those reps, you know, sort of that banking, and you know, you sort of process and you start to pick up certain speed. You start to get a little bit more comfortable with offenses. And so for me to miss that and then come back and then you sort of played in a game, I think two or maybe even 3 days later, it was really difficult to sort of get acclimated. You know, your body isn't the same. You haven't been practicing. So it took me about two and a half weeks to sort of get back on track. But at that point, the evaluation period is already over and it can be difficult. And so after that year, that whole staff, general manager and everybody else was fired. You know, one, I never saw, you know, I'm sure they talk, but I never saw our general manager and head coach ever speak, which probably isn't good. Two most important people in any business, if they never speak, there's probably a very, very high probability that that business or that company crumbles. And so that's exactly what happened. And so, but yeah, Kevin O'Connell came in, new general manager. But I always say, you know, nobody loves you more than the people that drafted you. And because they have that sort of vested interest, they had sort of had that pride and ego into your career, and then being able to say, hey, we saw something in this specific person that all you other teams didn't see, and the way we were able to develop him was like y'all weren't able to do. You know, I think that's always a big component. So then me going to the Cleveland Browns, I think I did a good job, especially early. I was a big fan of Drew Petsing, who's now the offensive coordinator with the Detroit Lions. That was my quarterback coach, and was a coming from a same system, that West Coast system, sort of a totally different philosophy. His mindset is, I can't necessarily tell you how to play as an individual, but as long as I can get you to play in rhythm and on time and execute at a high level, then that's my goal. But I can't tell Kellen Mond to play like Deshaun Watson and y'all to play like Jacoby Brissett, because y'all all play totally different, and then Josh Dobbs plays different. And so I think that's where I saw my most growth, and that he actually ended up leaving going into that following season, which I wish I would have had in. But, you know, there's so many different things that you learn and you carry throughout the NFL teams and the processes. Then once you sort of apply it to the work world, a lot of it is more just on, I think, sort of the tenacity and the I'm not going to quit mindset once you get to the business world, and sort of that there is no plan B. So you sort of don't take any no for an answer. And so your sort of willingness to go out and sort of hustle and build something is sort of, I think, one of the main things that I see from myself and then other athletes involved.
So when we talk about football and how it teaches you discipline, you know, it teaches you work ethic, teaches you teamwork, all the things, right? Money also requires a type of discipline, a little bit different. Can you tell us a little bit about how you navigated that, or how your relationship with money has changed, you know, throughout the course of your career? And I always like to ask if you could share with us any, you know, big ticket or splurged items that you might have, you know, treated yourself to.
Yeah, I mean, I think my big purchase whenever I first got to the NFL, one, I was supposed to have partnership with Jeep, so I wasn't going to have a car while I was living in Minnesota, so no car payment would have been really nice. But that sort of fell through a little bit and was a whole another side story, but ended up getting my dream car, Jaguar, and got an SUV, so it was brand new. But that was probably my only like actual real big purchase. And, you know, obviously it's financed. I don't even know if that's necessarily a big purchase. But, you know, I think a large part, you know, there's sort of this conversation between the way athletes spend money, you know, athletes going broke and things like that. And I'm not saying that athletes need to understand why athletes go broke, but I think from the outside world, people look at it totally different, and it's people don't really understand. There is a component of wanting to save money and, you know, watch your spending, but I don't think there's ever a component of the real world where you could be a CEO of a company and make seven figures, and then just off the snap of a finger, you don't know when it's going to come. Now you're going to make nothing, and there's no way for you to go be a CEO again. Once your football is over, it's really hard to say, hey, I'm going to create this business, and then in the first year, I'm going to make seven figures. A lot of people don't really take that into consideration. They're like, hey, how did you make $5 million in your career and now you don't have any money? It's like, well, yeah, it makes sense. One, you're spending money throughout your career, but it's usually not that first year where you are start to realize, hey, I need more money or I need to develop something. Usually it starts hitting like year three, year four, when you simply don't have the same capital, the same income coming in as obviously you're playing in the NFL. And then while other people and are going to college to build something, you're playing to play in the NFL and, you know, play your professional sport. So I just think that's one of the big components as athletes. It can be year two after injury. It can be year 10. You simply don't know when that money stops coming in. And so a large part of it is, how do you prepare for it? Because, yeah, early on, you can be too frugal and then you can say, well, man, I didn't really live my life the way I wanted to. You know, I made it to year 15 and I should have done things earlier. Or you maybe spend a little bit too much early on and then that career gets cut short after year two and you were a high draft pick, but things didn't work out. And then you go from making seven figures to making nothing. And then your next job isn't going to be another CEO job or another. It's you're going to build something from scratch. And so, you know, I think sort of the real world example is sort of that CEO getting fired. And then now you have to go start somewhere brand new company in a field that you're not familiar with as an analyst. And you're going to make, you know, less than a tenth of that, 85% of what you were making. And how can you still go be able to provide for your family while building something from scratch? And then is it even what you want to do? Because you sort of had this mindset of I can spend and operate and build these connections with this specific identity. And now you have a totally different identity in something that you never really prepared for, never really wanted. You know, most athletes don't want to sit down at an office desk or do something. It's all we've known is football. So I think it's a really interesting component. Once you can sort of try and put it in the real world perspective as much as you can, because it's not just so black and white where it's like, hey, athlete, you made X amount of dollars and you simply can't keep up with what you're spending per month now that, you know, football is over or now that basketball is over.
So insightful, especially the part where you talk about identity, right? It's like everything is riding on this identity that you now have, right? This character who you are, but also, you know, on the outside looking in, not everybody knows that, right? They see you as the player making great money. You've got family you're taking care of. Everybody sort of, you know, comes out of the woodwork because now they know that you've made it.
I think more people at least could understand exactly what athletes go through, but I would think that more athletes, they may be thankful for what they've accomplished and the dream that they're living, but it probably isn't the same exact vision that they had planned, simply because as we go to the NFL, we want to be the starter and we want to be able to make as much money as we can and win a Super Bowl and all these things. And probably out of 55 guys on a roster, you obviously have 11 offensive starters, you know, maybe it, 40% of those guys were actually living that dream of being a starter. The rest of guys are simply guys who are getting flushed out through team year by year.
And it is hard to stay. Obviously, you know, they say the lifespan in the NFL is probably 2, maybe 3 years. And so, you know, guys are getting flushed in and out all the time, and you're competing with guys who are saying the same thing as you are, that I'm a good player and I deserve this. And if I just get an opportunity, but if all 1,000 players who are in your exact position are saying, I just need an opportunity, let me prove it to you. It's like, how do you decide? A lot of it, you're simply just depending on luck and maybe sometimes a guy in front of you getting hurt, and that's the way your opportunity comes. And, you know, we saw, I think, Dak Prescott, that's how he got his start. I think a lot of times it is a bit of that luck factor and timing factor more than just how good are you as a player.
We've talked about this with other athletes we've had on the show, and you kind of alluded to it. So if you're a rookie, right, I mean, first round picks get monster signing bonuses right away, and then it kind of goes down as you go. Not that you're not making good money as a second, third, or fourth round pick, but how hard is it for young guys to not get kind of caught up in the lifestyle? If you're playing, you know, if you're on the Vikings now, right, Justin Jefferson's making, like, I don't know what he's making, but yeah, a lot of money a year. How hard is it to not go out with them or show up to the parking lot and have, like, no one's struggled with, like, an F5 Corolla when everyone else is driving Ferraris? So where's that balance? And what advice would you give younger guys? Kind of, again, kind of alluding to what you said, like, it's not easy all the time, but, you know, you also have to, financial planning is super important. It's to live within your means and try to have some long-term vision, because this career could end tomorrow or it could be 10 years. You never know.
Yeah. I mean, I saw with my own two eyes of guys who were undrafted free agents who were nowhere near making what Justin Jefferson or any of the top guys were making. And they weren't necessarily out there spending like them, but a lot of times when you're hanging with them, there is a bit of that influential part of, maybe if I spend this, it's okay. And enough of those types of spends, it can become a little bit too reckless. And sometimes you're just simply living paycheck to paycheck as an NFL player, which sounds crazy to most people. And the problem becomes sort of what we talk about is you're living paycheck to paycheck. That's sometimes not even good in the real world, but in the real world, usually that just doesn't abruptly stop randomly. And then you can't do anything like that that can get you paid sometimes, you know, high six figures at the age of 20 and 21, maybe 22 years old. And so, you know, I think it is tough. And, you know, I'm not even sure what the exact message is, because obviously it's easy to say save your money, but that could mean a lot of different things. But, you know, it's sort of like live below your means, but how long should you live below your means? When can you start to maybe splurge a little bit? Because sometimes you can get to that second contract, which is the ultimate goal, and you say, okay, you could splurge now, but then you get hurt after that initial year. Like, what do you do now? And so you may have sort of guaranteed money coming in. But most athletes, whenever they get hurt or whenever their career stops, that's not when the spending stops, because a lot of times we think we'll heal up, or even if we got cut, we'll just get back in the NFL. So it does become difficult and sometimes a tough pill to swallow. And we got to say, hey, our career is probably over, or we're not going to be able to make the same type of money outside of football and build something. And so a lot of times you hit that year three and year four, and your money is just not necessarily up, but you start to see maybe the writing on the wall, like, hey, I might need to start making some changes. Yeah, I think that's where probably wealth advisors, you know, probably do carry a really important role of, sometimes you might have to tell your athlete who's making $10 million a year, like, maybe it is a bad purchase. Because, you know, at least for me, on rookie contract, making $1 million, I think if you're making $1 million a year, you could spend money on about anything and be totally comfortable with it if you have $1 million coming in every year. You know, there's a lot of shopping that you can do where you don't even need to check the price. You know, when you book trips, you can book five-figure trips and not blink, and because you'll have another check coming in. And so, you know, that's on the probably on a low level, I could imagine, where guys who have these huge, ginormous contracts, right? But I think it is hard, to your point, of guys coming into the NFL or, you know, any league and saying, hey, you might have to be a little bit more frugal, or, you know, sort of watch your spending, Because one, what does that mean? And then how do you tell an athlete, especially probably coming in from NIL, how do you start to prioritize your money and have sort of tax planning and things like that? So it definitely can be difficult.
So that said, right, you talk about you making $1 million, but you're really not, right? If you take 40-ish% of it away from taxes, agent fees, and living expenses, all of a sudden that $1 million, it can become $400,000 or $300,000 pretty darn quick. And that's a big difference post-tax for folks that a lot of young people just aren't prepared or educated for, where we try to really help. Because it looks a lot better on paper than it does when it, you know, in April when the IRS says, well, I'm glad you had fun all year, but now you actually owe us money.
You know, I think as guys start to get a little bit more mature and it turns into, like, I'm not trying to maybe show off or guys in the locker room or maybe prove that I could be in this circle, then guys are maybe a little bit smarter, but sometimes you don't even make it to that point. And so that's where the difficult part comes in.
Kellen, I have a couple more questions for you, but I do want to know, tell me what's going on right now. Tell us what you're working on, where you see your future. What are you excited about right now?
I'm in the early stages of planning a big art event. So I don't know, it'll be in Texas. I don't know if I want to say the city yet. But yeah, you know, tailored for art collectors, more high net worth, ultra high net worth people, you know, going to bring in some, you know, big sponsors. But, you know, I think a large part of what I kind of see in the art space, there's a large group of people who rely on, you know, galleries and museums and art fairs, which, you know, I do think are brilliant and are sort of the backbone of the art world. And it's something I want to be a part of, but it's also how can you create unique experiences for people, and then also yourself as an artist, that you can sort of have free 100% control and range to do what you want with a event space, which work you curate and have that type of freedom. And so I'm sort of leaning into that early, especially here parts of Texas. And then as I start to gain bigger markets out in, you know, mainly hopefully New York and L.A., be able to get into those worlds. You know, I've been busy, a lot of networking, a bunch of events, traveling, try and go for the more luxury high end, because I do think, you know, your work should be a reflection of the venue space, which is also a reflection of the guests that you bring in and, you know, also sponsors. So, you know, trying to do things at a really high level, you know, everything 10 out of 10 quality.
Amazing. How did you get into that? Has it always been a kind of passion of yours?
No, definitely not. I started as a photographer when I was a rookie in the NFL. And, you know, sort of throughout here, we sort of talk about trying to find things outside of your sport. And so I think a lot of times athletes don't find certain things because we're so dialed in and locked in on our sport. But photography was sort of the other side component of the chaotic world of the NFL, sort of brought the peace and harmony of, I can do this by myself. All I need is a place to walk around, a camera, and I'm good. And so I think just over time, as I developed, you know, as a photographer and the quality of work started to get better, I sort of luckily ran into art curators, art advisors who complimented my work and like, hey, you might want to become an artist and explore this. And so this is while I was still playing, still sort of the middle of my career. So at the time, I was, one, knew nothing about that space. You know, most athletes, unfortunately, do not know a lot about the art world, which that's something hopefully I can change. But it's also part of a world that it's really hard to balance being an artist and then being a football player. And, you know, I think a lot of times too, when you're around collectors and, you know, people who want to invest into your work and invest into your career, they want to know that you're a full-time artist and this is just isn't some hobby that you're doing. So I sort of had to make the decision of, do I want to pursue and just chase after football, or do I want to become a full-time artist? That's where, you know, a lot of this was, you know, really fun. I was starting to have a lot of fun sort of building something from scratch in the art space and just figure out, how can I be unique in this space? You know, whenever you first launch, which changes do I need to make and which stuff is unneeded and what stuff do I need to add? And so You sort of fall in love with that process. And then sometimes you're like, man, I think if this is what I want to do, maybe chasing and chasing and chasing football, which a lot of us athletes do with sort of no stop in mind, it becomes really difficult, especially in this space where collectors and people who are involved in the art world, they want to know that this is a passion and a love that you have.
Yeah, it's special. I mean, you talked about earlier how football often is just your idea. It's more than what you do, right? It's your identity. It's like who you are to the world as a person. So for you to find a different passion, something that you really want to throw yourself into, especially so soon, I think it's really special, because there's a lot of people who play their whole careers and retire, whether they want to retire or not, that we talked about, and then have a really hard time kind of finding themselves outside of a locker room or outside of the field. So that's amazing that you found that and, you know, are already kind of building something, and we're excited to watch it.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely something that isn't, you know, I think most athletes are usually, they jump into real estate or some sort of investing because they do have capital. But a lot of times that may not keep your time as busy, time busy after, sure, you know, after your sport. And so, you know, luckily enough, I enjoy being busy and, you know, having difficult things to handle. And so I think that's sort of the competitive nature that football kind of gave me. And so you want more difficult tasks. As bad as it sounds, sometimes you do want to run into roadblocks, and it is a bit of that satisfying factor of being able to move past that. And in the business world, something that we've really never done, usually it's always dealing with adversity in the sports world. And so, you know, at least for me, a lot of the works, especially at this upcoming show that I'll have in a few months, are works from, you know, 2 and 3 years ago. So at a time period where I never, ever wanted to showcase my work, didn't even know being an artist was a thing. And so I think part of that dedication to the craft, sort of that refusal of being average, no matter what you planned on doing, was always something that was within me. And so it is, you know, we see certain works, no matter whether people were going to see it or whether people were going to see it and I was going to become an artist years later, people were going to see quality work. And so I think that's sort of that dedication and commitment to the craft, even before I can officially say I was ever committed to the craft.
Love it. So then one question we like to ask all of our guests on the podcast is, what does sweat equity mean to you?
You know, I always think of it something along the lines of just an extreme amount of work ethic, and you sort of get, you know, you put in something and you get out what, you know, you put in, and there's no cheat codes. There's no way around certain things. And I think especially as athletes who jump into the business space, you have a bit of an advantage because you can get in a lot of doors that normal people may not be able to get into, and sometimes work years to get into. But also there's a lot of people who have been working years to, one, develop their networks and build out certain portfolios and experience. And so a lot of times, whether it's collaborating with those type of people or getting in the rooms with those type of people, who, one, would love to be able to help out athletes when it comes to sort of the sort of business acumen side of it, not the commitment or discipline or maybe the sweat equity and sort of that work ethic. But I think it is a part of this. There's no cheat codes to business. There's no shortcuts, and everything, especially certain people, are going to have to build from scratch. But I think that's the satisfying part when we look back at your journey, because us as athletes, everything we did was built from scratch. And some people developed in, you know, 5 years, they played their sport, some 10, some 15, sometimes even 20 years ago. And so everything, like I said, was built from nothing. And we sort of, as we make it to the NFL, some who make it to college, we reflect back on where we were at our earlier stages in development, and just we sort of almost in shock that we were even able to get this far.
That's great. Totally agree. Kellen, thank you so much for joining us today on our Self Equity podcast. It was amazing getting to know you and hear about your experiences and see all the amazing things you have lined up ahead of you. We wish you all the best and continued success. And let's keep in touch and do it again.
Awesome. I appreciate y'all.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.